Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CXXXVIII, Rise of the Sasanian Empire. Severus Alexander was an emperor who spent much of his reign at war, but he was ill-suited to it and would likely prefer to be elsewhere. His main enemy was the Sasanians, an empire that rose out of the ashes of the Parthians, and would be a leading regional power for the next 400 years. Here's Kaelin Davenport. All right, so when we're talking about Severus Alexander as an emperor, one thing that comes up a lot in more modern writings especially is his attitude slash interactions with the Christians.
Yes, there's a couple of very famous passages in Historia Augusta's Life of Severus Alexander that deal with the Christians. So in Severus Alexander chapter 29, the author tells us that he would worship gods in the sanctuary of his lares, that's the household gods. In there he kept statues of the deified emperors, but only the best ones, the author tells us. And also Christ, Abraham, Orpheus, and others of the same character, and the portraits of his ancestors. So that's a very interesting passage. But then the author goes on to say in section 43 of the life, he also wished to build a temple of Christ and give him a place amongst the gods, a measure which they say was also considered by Hadrian. Alexander, however, was prevented from carrying out this purpose because those who examined the sacred victims ascertained that if he did, all men would become Christians and the other temples of necessity be abandoned. Mm. Now, both these passages, although often cited, are not historical. There was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Severus Alexander, for example, worshipped an image of Christ or Abraham or wanted to build a church or a temple to Christ. One of the reasons why the Historia Augusta might think this is that his mother, Julia Mamaea, did summon the Christian philosopher Origen to court. And we know this from Eusebius's History of the Church. So the fact that a Christian intellectual was welcome to court, I think, has later been embellished to paint the idea of Severus Alexander as a pro-Christian emperor who worshipped Christ.
I would have thought that he would have seen what happened to his cousin when you invite foreign gods into the Roman pantheon as well.
Yes, so there's that level of implausibility that you know, this would suddenly be welcomed by the Romans when Elagabalus hadn't been. And, you know, there's quite a difference as well. I mean, Sol Elagabal is one of many pagan gods in the pantheon, whereas if you're Christian, you would only worship Christ. There is a clear difference there. But this fits into tradition, which we find, especially with emperors of the 3rd century, that they are painted either as pro-Christian or anti-Christian by our later sources, particularly Eusebius and Lactantius. And this is because the issue of Christian persecution becomes even more heavily politicized in the 3rd century, emperors such as Valerian and Diocletian issuing empire-wide edicts of persecution. So emperors who don't do that are painted in a very positive pro-Christian light, but to the extent they were said to be even worshipping Christ.
Mm. So there isn't a huge amount to say about his life in Rome from this point on, mostly because it's concerned with the Persian Wars, where his story goes. So what can we say to put a cap maybe on his time in Rome? He does a few building projects of note. Mm. We'll start with those.
Yes. So first of all, there's the Temple of Elagabal on the Palatine Hill, which Elagabalus had set up. Now, of course, that was a major insult and was not warmly received. So Severus Alexander actually converted it into a temple of Jupiter Altor, that is Jupiter the Avenger.
Good decision.
Yes, yes, exactly. So he restores Jupiter to the supreme place in the pantheon of gods.
Mm.
He also rebuilt the Baths of Nero, which lie on the Campus Martius, and he renames them after himself, a thing that Roman emperors like to do, the less scrupulous of them anyway, you know, when rebuilding something, that they name them after themselves. And he built a new aqueduct, which also carried his name to supply the Baths of Alexander on the Campus Martius. And you can't see them today because they lie under all that area between the Pantheon and the Piazza Navona. However, if you're walking along, you can sometimes see a slight rise in the ground level. Mm. And then you're walking down the street and suddenly there's a dip. Well, that rise is caused by the remains of the baths being beneath them.
Oh, okay.
So he did invest in the structures of the city of Rome during that period when he was based in the city.
And the other thing that I noticed when I was reading Herodian is that you get all these quotes that just really reflect how young and innocent he is.
Mm. Yes. So, I mean, the historian Augustus' narrative is designed to portray Severus Alexander as the ideal prince. So any problems are ascribed to his mother, Mamia. So the Historia Augusta has, in chapter 41, he never had dramatic entertainments at his banquets, but his chief amusement consisted in having young dogs play with little pigs, or partridges fight with one another, or tiny little birds fly about to and fro. As you said, you know, captures the image of the innocent prince. It's interesting, you know, the things that the Historia Augusta talks about are plausible. Partridge fighting was a common pastime. Regular listeners may remember that Marcus Cornelius Fronto was a big fan of partridges. These kind of things is what an innocent teenager would do. And the Historia Augusta even has this anecdote about him using the public baths together with the people, but he's wearing a bathing costume, which I find intriguing considering the Romans bathed naked. I don't know where that comes from. But there's clearly all these various sort of anecdotes which are designed to portray him as the ideal young man loved by the populace.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose in the same sort of vein, Severus Alexander was not confident in standing up to the military. He didn't seem to have that kind of background or thought.
Yeah, so this is the problem when you have a young emperor. I mean, presumably he's someone who's been trained to ride and fight like other young men of his ilk. But he's quite different from someone like Septimius Severus, who already had a successful military career behind him. And it may have been that he was prevented from taking a more active role during his youth by Mamia. We don't know. But he does actually lead two campaigns in person. Mm. So I don't think we should underestimate him. But there is certainly this tradition that he's at the mercy of the Praetorian Guard in Rome. So Cassius Dio says, because he ruled the soldiers with a strong hand when he was a provincial governor, the other soldiers complained about him to Ulpian much earlier in the reign. But then again, when Cassius Dio became consul for the second time in 229, Dio says that Severus Alexander, and I quote, became afraid that they might kill me if they saw me in the insignia of my office, and so he bade me spend the period of my consulship in Italy somewhere outside Rome. So apparently the soldiers so resented Dio's stern disciplinarianism, and this news had spread to Rome, even though he was, you know, a governor in Pannonia and Dalmatia, indicates that Severus Alexander couldn't control his troops if he couldn't guarantee his consul's safety.
And this kind of lack of control over his troops, or maybe, you know, the lack of trust that his troops place in his decisions, is really going to turn against him in later on in his life.
It will be the reason for his downfall. So during the reign of Severus Alexander, there's a momentous change in geopolitics on Rome's eastern frontier. And this is the demise of the Parthian Empire and their conquest by the Sasanian Persians. So Listeners may remember that way back in the episodes on Caracalla, we talked about civil war that had torn apart the Parthian Empire between the brothers Volgaces V and Artabanus IV. After Caracalla's murder, Artabanus IV negotiated a peace treaty with the Emperor Macrinus.
I think at the time I might have said, hey, this is the last Parthian war after hundreds of years of fighting the Parthians.
That's right, exactly.
Technically
and
correct.
It is correct. And Macrinus signs this peace treaty, which results in a large indemnity being paid to the Parthians, but it can be presented as a peace treaty. However, there is trouble brewing for the Parthians, already divided between the two brothers, in the province of Persis, which is in southwestern Iran today. So here we see the rise of Ardashir, who was the son of the vassal king of Persis, Papak, and he owed allegiance to the Parthian king Artabanus. After Papak died, Ardashir killed his older brother, and so by around AD 212, he established himself as king of Persis. So this is right when Caracalla was just coming to the throne. So this trouble within the Parthian Empire had been brewing for a long time.
Yeah.
Now, I should talk briefly about the nomenclature here. So Ardashir is called Artaxerxes by Cassius Dio and Herodian, Greek sources writing about this period.
Does Cassius Dio? Oh, he does talk about it, yes, sorry.
Very briefly at the end, yes. And this is effectively the Greek transliteration of the Persian, but I'll call him Ardashir rather than Artaxerxes.
Okay, so that would have been the name that he would have been known by, not the name that he was given by sources.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Sure.
So Ardashir is king of Persis after unseating his older brother, and gradually began to expand his territory to pose a threat to Artabanus, the Parthian king.
So Artabanus is meantime distracted by what's going on with the fight with Rome, what's going on with the fight with his brother, and he's not paying attention to his flanks.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So he's occupied in Syria, Armenia, the Western Front for him.
Mm.
And it's difficult to work out exactly what takes place because of the nature of our sources. We are dependent on Cassius Dio and Herodian, who, of course, are not well informed about internal disputes within the Parthian Empire. We depend on Ardashir's own representation of what happens in rock-cut reliefs, which he created to monumentalize his triumph. And we're also dependent on later sources, such as the chronicle of Al-Tabari, who lived in the 9th and 10th centuries AD.
Yeah.
So what we do know is that in AD 224, Ardashir successfully defeated Artabanus in battle on the plain of Hormozgan, which is now in southwestern Iran. The date at which he defeated Artabanus' brother Volgaces is uncertain, depending on how one interprets the numismatic evidence. Some historians have him defeated before Artabanus, others have him holding out for several extra years.
Mm.
But it's clear that Ardashir's defeat of Artabanus is the key moment, after which Ardashir takes the title of Shahanshah, or King of Kings. So Ardashir is the first of the Sasanian Persians.
So the Sasanian part, is that a label that we give them, or did they just see themselves as the Persian Empire at this point?
They actually called themselves the King of Kings. They talk of the world around Iran as well as the world outside Iran.
Mm.
The name of Sasanians actually comes from Ardashir's mythical ancestor, Sasan, who he takes as the founder of his dynasty. We don't really know who Sasan was, if he ever existed. We're dealing with sort of like a Romulus-like figure here as an equation for the Roman world. He may have been a high priest or perhaps a deity. He is certainly made into a god by Adash here. So we call them the Sasanian Persians to distinguish them from the Achaemenid Persians, the empire that Alexander the Great fought against.
Did they see themselves as a continuation of that empire?
They didn't know, but okay. Our sources, Herodian and Cassius Dio, do see them as a continuation of that empire.
Yeah, okay. So that explains why they went with Persians in their writing.
Very much so.
Yeah.
So in Dio and Herodian, Adashir is trying to revive this past before the Parthians. This is not what we find in Adashir's own inscriptions and reliefs. So he celebrated his victory over Artabanus with rock reliefs at various sites throughout Iran. The most famous are those at Naqshi Rostam near Persepolis. So Adashir is shown on horseback, trampling over the deceased Artabanus, and the god Ahura Mazda is shown making Adashir the king of kings.
Mm.
So these texts and monuments, which of course are given from his own perspective, do not talk about reviving the Achaemenid Persian Empire. They talk about his god-given right given to him by Ahura Mazda to rule Iranshah, which is Iran, that territory. So that's quite different from how Dio and Herodian, in their classicizing Greek historical way, see it. They interpret in terms they can understand.
So for our purposes, essentially Sasanian Empire then, we're going to...
Yep, Sasanian Empire, Sasanian Persians, we'll call them that.
Okay, yes. Sure. So how did Rome take this development? Is this something that they were worried about, or did they just see it as, oh, you're Parthians with different flags, this doesn't change anything for us?
Well, I think Rome was caught off guard, a bit like Artabanus himself. The chronology of the 220s is very difficult to understand, in part because Cassius Dio telescopes his narrative, and in part because it's difficult to always reconcile the dates between Herodian and what we know from other sources. What we do know is that after conquering the Parthians in Iran and then in the Arabian Peninsula, Ardashir tried to invade Armenia, the client kingdom, the buffer state between Rome and now Persians, but he was defeated. He did have more success invading Roman territories, especially Mesopotamia, the province of Mesopotamia that had been established by Septimius Severus. Here he captured the cities of Nisibis and Carrhae, but failed to take Hatra. And this is when, at least in Herodian's narrative, the emperor Severus Alexander and his administration in Rome become alert to the problem. And Herodian has the governors of Mesopotamia and Syria writing to the emperor for help. We need you on the scene. We need you to come to our aid.
And is Ardashir acting on what he believes to be his right to territory that he rules?
Yes, we can certainly believe that he wants to not only be king of kings of Iran, but also the areas outside. Rome is his biggest threat in that regard.
So what essentially happens at this point is that Rome is going to enter a war, not with the Parthians this time, but with the Persians, as they call them.
Mm.
And the war commences, we've got the date of 231 CE.
Yes.
When Severus Alexander is emperor. So how does he get the news that there's a threat that needs to be dealt with?
Well, Herodian definitely places the emphasis on Alexander as a young man being controlled by his advisors. He has Alexander being upset at the report. He says in Book 6, Section 2, Subsection 3, since childhood he had been brought up in conditions of peace and had always been attached to the comforts of the city. Therefore, his first decision after communicating with his counsellors was to send a diplomatic representative and put a halt to the aggression of the barbarian and check his expectations by means of a letter. So he tries a diplomatic solution.
Consulting with his advisors in italics.
Yes, yes.
He's got to go and check first that he can actually do this sort of thing.
Yeah, partially this is Herodian's way of telling the story of Severus Alexander's reign as an aristocratic government, as opposed to a tyrannical government who talks with his leading senators and then reaches a consensus decision.
Trying for peace, writing this letter, sending the embassy does not work?
No, it fails. Herodian tells us that Ardashir does not heed the warning and instead presses on further into Roman territory. And this leads the eastern governors, Herodian tells us, to demand Severus Alexander's presence in the eastern provinces themselves. And this is really important because we're seeing a change in the expectations of the emperor, particularly from the reign of Marcus Aurelius onwards, and becomes more pronounced in the 3rd century AD. This is the idea that emperors shouldn't leave major defensive campaigns to their generals, but needed to take to the front in person.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the Emperors of Rome podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Severus Alexander goes to war. But until then, please take care of yourself and each other. I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.